business section of the bar, I think, and from Senator Courtney is here, has gratefully come down and blessed our presence. But we have a new person sitting over there behind the computer we need to introduce to the committee. Keith, you want to introduce Pam Brunell?
Yes, this is Pam Brunell. She's new to the session, new to the committee. The committee was so hard on the last committee assistant that she up and left, but to a very good job that had been in the offing. So we're pleased to have Pam here, and sitting behind her is one of the best committee assistants in the building. So you're in good hands.
Well, good. Hopefully we won't be quite so hard on this committee assistant, and we can keep her for more than one meeting. Yeah, a good goal for this group. Well, without further ado, then we'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 116. And Senator Courtney, would you please come forward and explain to us what you've got here?
Thank you. Here, can I ask Bob Olson briefly, Mark?
Oh, I thought you were on the fly. This is solo.
What I'm going to do is make a brief introduction, but if I might ask Bob Olson, Professor Robert C. Hart to come forward, because they're going to do the, I'm just going to tell you how we got here, a very brief statement, because I'm the one who started all this back in D.C., so is that all right if I bring these, they've already joined me, so I should have, is that all right, Professor, Chair, Byer?
Proceed, Senator. Professor now, huh?
I'm Peter Courtney, 2925 Island View Drive, North in Salem, 97303, and I'm a state senator, District 17. And last session, in the form of Senate Bill 546, I brought this issue to the Oregon legislature. 546 last session was also filed as a bill that was sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary to deal with remedies for shareholders of corporations whose shares are not listed on the National Securities Exchange, a regularly traded, basically, I think what they're called, closed corporation. The issue was one that arose from a situation in the Portland area, a situation which went into a court proceeding, and there were some problems in this area, and so I introduced the bill to perhaps come up with remedies to deal with it. The bill was heard by the Senate Judiciary Committee. I was a member of that committee, and the Oregon State Bar came forward and had some concerns, and we worked and worked, but we just could not, there wasn't enough time to deal with the issue, and we closed the session with the understanding that we would go into the interim and that a task force would be formed to try to deal with the issue and bring back a piece of legislation to this session, and that is now in the form of Senate Bill 116, which was pre-session filed by the Interim Judiciary Committee. And Bob Olson is here, but the key player is to chair the task force is sitting next to me, and that is Professor Robert C. R., Professor of Law, Willamette University Law School. And I just am going to read briefly from a statement in a letter he sent way back in February 28, 2000 to members of the Senate, the Interim Judiciary Committee, on which he said that he was serving as chair of the Oregon State Bar Business Law Section's Task Force on Closed Corporations and Shareholder Rights. This letter was sent to update the members of the Interim Judiciary Committee on the task force. The task force was established after the introduction of 546 during the 1999 legislative session. The bill sought to modify the law applicable to minority shareholders in closed-held corporations when they seek a judicial remedy for oppression by the corporation or by the majority shareholders. Even though many Oregon business attorneys were interested in the concept raised by Senate Bill 546, the bill did not pass. Many people in the business community were concerned that Senate Bill 546, as it was written, could potentially undermine significant principles of the corporate form of business. Oregon business attorneys and other business groups also were concerned about the effect on all of the owners of the corporation and the ability to continue the business. The task force is composed of attorneys from large and small firms around the state representing all sides of the dispute within closed corporations. To date, the task force has met six times. That letter was dated February 28, 2000. There were many more other meetings. That just is a lead-in as to the magnitude of the effort that was done to bring us today in Senate to Senate Bill 116. That is going to basically be my opening lead-in statement and perhaps my only real statement of any significance, not that that's a significant statement. I must say, Chair Beyer, that I heard last week, after I was assured that everything was in order and thought everything was in order, I started to hear that there was now some concerns, and I did not know quite what, but then I heard just about 2 hours ago the famous letters AOI, and was informed that AOI had some concerns, and Chair Beyer, you and I talked briefly as we sat beside each other in the Judiciary Committee that I had heard that there was something going on with AOI. I don't know what is going on with AOI. They haven't talked to me, but just to be up front with my Senate colleagues, because I like to do that, I now understand there are some concerns with AOI, with 116. I don't know what they are. I don't know how substantially they are. I just really hope that given the incredible effort that started way back last session, went all through the interim. I did not serve in that task force because I am not certified smart in this kind of area. And in fact, this kind of stuff, as you've learned just moments ago from dealing with the UCC and Article 9 up in the Senate Judiciary Committee, I would take my life if I served on these kinds of task forces because I'm just not built this way personality-wise. But I do know that an incredible amount of heavy lifting has gone on with this piece of legislation. A lot of parties have been brought together. This gentleman to my right has worked his head off on it, and I really hope whatever the concerns are, they can be worked out through your leadership and this leadership of this committee, Chair Beyer, so that we can move Senate Bill 116 to the Senate floor and perhaps develop, deal with this issue once and for all. That's my statement. You were very good to allow me to even speak here today. I congratulate you on moving so quickly to the public hearing stage, because this, I've already been told by House members, boy, you folks are really moving over in the Senate. So I congratulate you and the members of the committee, and with that, I have very little else to say to be meaningful since I am not well-versed in shares or shareholders or minority or majorities or closed or open or anything else. All I know is stuff like, you know, how do you get up in the morning and things like that.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. Do you have any questions of a good senator from Salem?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Senator Courtney, what was the situation in Portland that brought this issue forward? I'm familiar with that situation.
Well, that situation can be explained in detail by Steve Nato, who is in the audience behind me. It involved the Nato family and their situation, which ended up in a very well-publicized case in court, and I would prefer that he, since he is truly, as we say in law, the expert witness on the situation in Portland that brought it about, as he chooses to do so. And I do remember the very well-publicized court case in which they had a situation there, and that was the situation specifically, and I hope I haven't offended Mr. Steve Nato by mentioning that on the record, but that was the case and that was the issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Decker, did you have a question?
I did not.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Senator Courtney, for introducing this in a very brief manner, which I know for you was very brief. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, Bob Olson, Oregon State Bar. Senator Courtney did most of the lead-in, so I don't have to do very much of that. I appreciate the senator's comments because this bill does have a history. The issue has a history. It was important last time. A lot of issues were raised, and they've been dealt with by the Business Law Section Task Force. In fact, all the bills before you are law improvement bills from the Business Law Section. You'll be hearing quite a bit from them this session, both on their own bills and other bills, and they have been historically active in the process, and I know with Andy Morrow and the other members of that group, they will continue to be very active. Many of them are routine bills. This involves major policies, and therefore it has also become kind of a law improvement priority of the state bar, and we also just heard of some new questions about the bill, and we'll bend over backwards to work with those interests to identify their issues and see if we can easily resolve them between the hearings and the work session you may have. So we're, I think, prepared to go forward on that. the task force has been very active, and very important statutory guidance is provided in Senate Bill 116 in terms of oppressive conduct and other issues that have come up through these two pieces of legislation, last session and this session. So with that, I will turn it over to Professor Art, who headed up our task force on this issue.
These task forces, these committees from OSB, broad general representation, just like most things.
Yes.
You guys have a Republican on there.
I would have guessed most of your task force members probably were Republican.
Most likely.
Senator Courtney, it's an easy test to pass this committee, I guess.
You might mention.
I don't know, Mr. Chair. Were there any women?
Go ahead, Professor.
So I'm, as introduced, Robert Art, Professor of Law at Willamette University. I was chair of this task force that engaged in a very extensive, painstaking effort. The meetings were every two or three weeks over a seven-month period. The task force as a whole consisted of every lawyer in the state who had any interest in this, and there was substantial interest. There were well over 100 who were on our email list who received regular notices of meetings, minutes of meetings, copies of the drafts of proposals, and any comment that they provided were taken into account and affected the outcome. There was an executive committee composed of lawyers from large and small firms on all sides of this issue. The list of them is in a letter that I distributed that I believe you have. So you will probably see some names familiar to you. They're a good selection of the lawyers who do corporate law work in the state. The bill affects corporations whose stock is not traded in any public market, so not on the stock exchange, not on NASDAQ. These are what are called closely held companies. In corporations like this, stock ownership is not merely a passive investment, such as owning 100 shares of IBM. If you don't like the management of IBM and you own their stock, the solution is to sell the stock on the market. That provides you an easy and effective way of getting the value out of your investment. In close corporations, in contrast, shareholders are commonly actively engaged in the business. They're directors, officers, employees. They depend on the corporation for their livelihood. That's their primary asset. When there are disputes within a corporation, the majority has a great deal of power to damage the interests of the minority. They can, for example, remove them from employment, fire them as directors and as officers. They can refuse to pay dividends. They can generally keep them from getting any income from the corporation or having any voice and control. The minority own stock that should be valuable, because the business is valuable, but they cannot get value out of their stock because there's no market for it. They can't dissolve the business the way partners can. They're basically trapped except for judicial remedies, and that's the importance of this bill and of the case law. Oregon courts have provided substantial remedies. We have a rather well-developed body of law, frequently cited by other jurisdictions. It makes clear that the majority holders, majority owners, owe a fiduciary duty to the minority shareholders to give them full disclosure, to act honestly, to act in good faith, to act for the benefit of the corporation as a whole, including the minority, not just for their own benefit. The courts have given various remedies suited to the circumstances. Most often, a forced buyout. The majority or the corporation must pay the fair value of the stock to the minority shareholder. That's a remedy that resolves the dispute. It allows the business to continue. It gives fair value to the departing shareholder, with fair value being determined by the court. The anomaly of all this is that
virtually none of it is in the Corporation Act. If you look in the Corporation Act, the only provision speaking to this issue is ORS 60.661 that says a court can dissolve a corporation in case of oppression. Dissolution is probably the worst solution for everyone. Why dissolve a going concern? In fact, courts rarely or never provide dissolution, and yet that's the only remedy mentioned in the statute. This bill would correct that anomaly. Basically, its provisions are these, and you see these also on a one-page summary on the letter that I provided. Briefly, it lists that the bill would list in the statute all of the remedies that are in fact now available. It encourages courts to use the buyout remedy, which is the most common and the most logical, by specifying procedure for the buyout. It makes clear that dissolution is not the preferred remedy. In fact, it's the last resort, to be used only if the others are not effective. In choosing a remedy, courts may consider the reasonable expectations of the shareholders as they were at the outset of the business and as they developed over the course of the business. And finally, it provides a means to bring the litigation to an early end. Any of the defendants or the corporation can make an offer at an early stage in the litigation to buy the shares of the aggrieved shareholder. Once the offer is made, it's binding. The shares are then purchased at the price that the parties agree to, or if they cannot agree, at a price and terms determined by the court, to be fair. That terminates the litigation early without having to go through the full-length trial. And that, is, in summary, is the proposal. It has the consensus approval of the task force, composed of well over 100 Oregon lawyers. It has the approval of the business law section of the state bar. I believe that Steve Nato will discuss his views on it. His bill in the last legislature was what gave the impetus to this process. He participated actively in this process, and I believe he will say that he agrees with this result. It brings Oregon's Corporation Act into line with the latest version of the Model Business Corporation Act, which is the act that is the basis of Oregon's corporation law and the law of the majority of jurisdictions around the country. If you would like additional information about the proposal or the means by which it was developed, I'd welcome the opportunity to respond.
Thank you. Senator Decker.
Thank you, Professor Art, in terms of the task force negotiations, what were the areas that attracted the largest contention amongst your task force members?
The primary issue was the standard called reasonable expectations. Currently, Oregon case law focuses on fiduciary duty of the majority owing to the minority shareholders, and around the country, that's the typical approach to the problem, to determine whether the majority violated their fiduciary duty. An alternate approach is to determine whether the majority violated the reasonable expectations that the minority had. In most cases, this will lead to exactly the same result, using different terminology. But in some cases, there'll be differences. For example, if the majority fires the minority from employment, removes them from the position and the salary that goes with it, under the fiduciary duty analysis, you would ask, was this for the benefit of the corporation? Under the reasonable expectation standard, you would say, does it violate the expectations of the minority shareholder? Suppose that the minority shareholder was stealing from the corporation or was simply an incompetent, ineffective employee. Under the fiduciary duty analysis, the conclusion would be removing that employee was the correct thing to do. It was for the benefit of the corporation. Under the reasonable expectations theory, you would argue at least that the person should not be removed because it violates that person's expectations. There are a few jurisdictions that go that direction. That was a major area of contention. The task force concluded that we should stick with our existing fiduciary duty analysis. There's plenty of Oregon case law, plenty of case law around the country that supports that, and that was the resolution. The term reasonable expectations is used in this statute, but it's used only after the determination has been made that the shareholder plaintiff deserves a remedy. It's used not in determining whether there should be a remedy, but rather which remedy.
And, Mr. Chair, was the task force able to reach unanimous decision on the final product, but also on the reasonable expectation? And then what is the standard for establishing reasonable expectation?
There was consensus as to the final result. As in any deliberative process involving a great number of people, not everyone got all that they wanted, but they were agreeable to the final result. As to the definition of reasonable expectations, there is none in the statute, and that would be a matter that would have to be applied by a court, under the specific facts of a corporate situation.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, Senator Courtney, so we don't lead you to injure yourself having to listen to this kind of argument, you're welcome to leave the room if you could. Steve Nato.
Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Steve Nato. I reside at 1330 Northeast 26, number 4 in Portland, Oregon. And I appreciate you hearing this bill so early in the session. As was previously discussed, I was kind of the instigator of why we are all here today on this bill 2 years ago. And this is not an issue of esoteric corporate law. This is an issue that affects a substantial number of people in the state of Oregon because our economy, our state, is dominated by small, closely held corporations. This is not like the state of Delaware where they've got the IBMs and General Motors, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a real issue. It's a live issue affecting a lot of the citizens in this state. And although there was earlier testimony that the kind of the genesis of this bill arose out of litigation that involved my family, I'm also a member of the bar and do a lot of legal work in this area, and I can also attest that there are a lot of other families out there who are struggling with the very issues that our family struggled with. And I truly believe that the current state of the law does not provide make it easy for families and other closely held corporations to resolve their disputes in a manner that is efficient and doesn't lead to a lot of cost and expense and a lot of emotional damage to the relationships involved. I think the best way to look at this bill and to look at these situations is we're talking about a corporate divorce. And as we've learned over the years that we don't force people to stay in marriages that they are not happy with, and we no longer require them to prove that one member or one party to the marriage was at fault, if you will, I think that's kind of the direction that I see corporate law moving. And and where this bill moves us closer to. I think one of the areas where the current state of the law fell down was in this idea of one side or the other having to prove fault. And when you have a closely held business where people are working very closely together, it's never really one party doing, or it's rarely two people, or it's rarely a situation of fault. I mean, it's a situation where people can no longer get along and remain in a close personal relationship in business. And so it then becomes, how do you separate their interests? And as Professor Hart said, it's unlike a partnership. It's very difficult to separate your interests in a corporation, especially one where you don't have a market for the shares. So if the parties can't figure out a way to do it voluntarily, they end up in court. One thing I can, again, attest to is that these cases, because the standard is so vague right now, and there are so many issues involved, they're extremely expensive cases to litigate. They take a substantial amount of time and money. And, again, because it involves a lot of interpersonal issues, it becomes just like a personal divorce, a marital divorce. It raises a lot of issues that no one ever wants to raise, especially in a court of law. And it effectively, or in many cases, it effectively destroys the relationship of the parties going forward. I talked with a member of a family business whose case was tried over 20 years ago involving him and his brothers and sisters, and he told me in the 20 years that ensued after the case, he had not spoken with any of his brothers and sisters after that. So these are very, very powerful emotional cases, and they come to the court as if it's kind of a corporate battle for corporate control, like Mr. Icahn and KKNR, when in reality it is a much more personal type of issue. So I think what our bill does is it helps the courts focus on the issues. The most important issue is, how do you get the parties to separate their interests and look at alternative remedies that, again, as Professor Arntz stated, does not, involve having to dissolve the corporation and hurt, not only the shareholders but also employees and suppliers. And I can also say that, I participated in virtually all of the meetings where our task force met, and I support the result. I think it is a good balanced approach. There were legitimate issues raised by members of the bar on, if you will, the other side of the issue, and I think through much discussion and arguing and heated debate, I saw their point of view, and I think they saw mine to some extent. And so we I think, produced a very balanced piece of legislation, which I would heartily request that you move forward in this process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Thank you.
All right. Betsy and Ben Featherston.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Betsy Earls from Associated Oregon Industries. We have a few concerns about the bill before you today, and with me to discuss those with you is Ben Featherston, who is a member of the AOI Executive Committee and also a practitioner here in town.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ben Featherston. I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Salem with Clark Lindauer Featherston, Edmonds & Whipple. I've been a lawyer for almost 20 years. The past 15 years, I've been practicing almost exclusively in the areas of business, corporate, real estate, and estate planning. I have concerns about the legislation. I think that it's not necessary to restate existing law, and I'm concerned that the legislation does go beyond existing law. The breadth of circumstances giving rise to remedy and the scope and breadth of the remedies, permitting courts essentially to make some fundamental corporate decisions, I think upsets the reasonable expectations of existing corporations and existing shareholders. In addition, I believe that the legislation may have an impact on many estate plans that have involved valuation of minority shares of stock in connection with gifting, and to the extent that we're changing the rules for those It'll have an impact on those estate plans. And I have concerns about the fact that the legislation applies both to current corporations and to future corporations. Corporations now typically will have arrangements in place, contracts called shareholder agreements or buy-sell agreements, among all the shareholders of the corporation to deal with all of the issues that Mr. Nato described and to avoid what might be characterized as an ugly divorce. I have concerns about the impact of legislation on those kinds of pre-existing contractual arrangements.
Is that it? Is that the end of your testimony?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gorley.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I beg your pardon. There was one more thing I wanted to add. I was one of the 100 members of the email list that was described earlier. I was not able to participate in the task force. I have talked with some other members of that email list, and they share the concerns that I have. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Featherston, we heard earlier testimony that Senate Bill 116, as it has been drafted, would bring Oregon in line with the Model Business Corporation Act, and I assume that means best practices. Does AOI have a position or thoughts about not being in line with the Model Business Corporation Act?
Answer that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, AOI doesn't actually have a position at this point because, as you can imagine, we probably have members on both sides of the issue. What we have right now are some members that have significant concerns that we would like to be able to work out with the Bar Association. We appreciate the opportunity to do that, but we haven't taken a position one way or the other on the bill or on Oregon being out of conformity with any model act.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dick.
Thank you. In some ways, you answered the question, but you were a part of the work group and did voice your opposition to, I guess, the executive committee and the chair at some point during their deliberations as to the nature of your opposition to.
I believe that I sent one email message to the committee. I can't tell you right now exactly who it went to. I think it was with the secretary who was managing the email list. I did also speak with some of my peers in the legal community who likewise, who were situated similarly to myself, could not attend any of the meetings or participate, but did receive the emails, and they also have concerns.
Thanks. So let me get this straight. If this bill is to pass, you're saying this could supersede or change current contracts that exist in buy-sell agreements and corporations now?
I'm concerned that that could be a result, yes.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on Senate Bill 116?
Can I respond?
Certainly. Come forward again.
Steve Nato again, record. On that specific issue, this bill does not at all impact the ability of corporations to enter into buy-sell agreements or any kind of corporate governance agreements. In fact, the whole purpose of this bill is to deal with those corporations who have not had the wise legal counsel that is available out there, and these are situations where, for one reason or another, there was no buy-sell agreement or one that took into account all the issues that arise. And another interesting is what happens in a corporation, and one of the strongest aspects of our economy, and we talk about it a lot in this state, is that, you know, we pride ourselves on the fact that we have family businesses that go back 3 or 4 or 5 generations. Well, the buy-sell agreement that was drafted for great-grandpa and his uncle may not really work for their great-grandchildren. And in fact, in our family, that's exactly the case, is we had a buy-sell agreement that dealt with really the two principal shareholders, but it impacted and it came into effect upon you know, a generation later when the issues that were addressed when the buy-sell was originally drafted had changed, you know, dramatically, and so the thing did not work at all. And that happens again in many, many situations. A lot of our law is set up to, you know, to allow corporations and other entities to draft their own corporate governance agreements, but when for whatever reason those agreements don't exist, there needs to be a fallback standard to apply. And again, the committee, the task force worked long and hard and came up with Senate Bill 116 as kind of the best practice way to try and solve those issues when you do not have the corporate governance agreements to resolve the parties' differences.
Thank you. Well, obviously, legal minds differ in opinion on this issue, as we find in most any issue. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 116. Obviously, there are some issues here that may be able to be worked out, maybe not. We'll have to give a little time to let the interested parties maybe get together and see if it can be worked out. So, that. Let Mr. Putman know if in the near future we come to an agreement on this or don't come to an agreement, and we'll take a look at it at that point in time. Thank you. We will now open a public hearing on the 117. Mr. Putman, you gotta give us a little bit of the background here. Or you rather like the party that be. Fill us in.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding that this is a cleanup of prior legislation, and in articles of organization or the operating agreements that have to do with limited liability companies, it makes it clear what items they can put in their agreement that do not violate what's called the duty of loyalty. And the duty of loyalty has to do with their obligations to the other members of their company, as I understand it. I believe there's someone here from the State Bar who can speak more closely on that.
Thank you. Mr. Andrew Morrow?
My name is Andrew Morrow. I'm an attorney with Foster Pepper and Scheffelman in Portland. I also am the legislative chair of the business law section of the Oregon State Bar, which has submitted this bill for its pre-session filing. I'm going to go through this rather briefly because most of what's involved in this bill is technical corrections to the Limited Liability Company Act, which is the result of a bar task force adopted that led to legislation in 1993. As Mr. Putman indicated, one of the things that is dealt with this bill has to do with the duty of loyalty of members of a limited liability company to each other. Absent some agreement to the contrary, there is an obligation of members of a limited liability company to provide business opportunities that come to the company rather than taking advantage of those themselves, and an obligation to account for any profits generated from those activities. The problem that exists in this situation is that often limited liability companies are created for a very narrow, specific purpose. Over the years, I've worked with various developers who develop projects. In my experience, some of it has been nursing homes and assisted living facilities, where they obtain financing from a group of partners for a specific project. This is also true in apartment development, a lot of other kinds of real estate development. The intention, ordinarily, in those projects is to finance a specific building. And the developer, in obtaining that money, wants to be able to go on and develop other properties outside of the scope of that limited liability company. In doing that, the typical approach is to put provisions in the operating agreement of the limited liability company for the purpose of defining what is the scope of the project and allowing the members to proceed with other projects independent of the entity. There were some changes made to the provisions in the Limited Liability Company Act in the 99 session dealing with these duty of loyalty issues. Concerns were raised that the provisions that were added weren't sufficiently clear as to how one could go about dealing with these kind of conflicting situations. And the purpose of part of this bill is simply to deal with that situation. The bill amends ORS 63.155 to reorganize some of the existing language and to add what is now Section 11, which describes how an operating agreement or articles of organization can be worded so as to allow someone to essentially compete with the limited liability company, but by agreement so that the parties know what is happening there. The balance of the bill deals with more technical issues. The second section really is designed to address the question of when these changes in duty of loyalty responsibilities are effective and to allow the opportunity for existing limited liability companies to continue under previous law for a period of time or to elect to be put under these new provisions. Section 4 of the bill adds a provision to the Limited Liability Company Act comparable to what's in the Business Corporation Act to the effect that the legislature reserves the right to amend or repeal the statute. This is to address any questions that might be raised with respect to constitutional issues of impairment of contract by changing the statute. Finally, Section 5 of the bill is to address a technical question with respect to how articles of organization are to be worded when they're filed. Basically, the limited liability company is required to state whether it is to be managed by its members, which means that the members all participate in the decision-making process, or whether it is to be managed by a manager or managers, which means that those functions are delegated to someone similar to a general partner in a limited partnership or a board of directors in a corporation. The issue is, does it have to say one manager or multiple managers? And the effort is to avoid having to designate in advance whether there's one manager or multiple managers, as that situation can change over time. Finally, the other item that you have with my written testimony is an amendment which was presented to me today, which also deals with a technical issue. It is the problem of what happens when articles of organization are filed to organize a limited liability company. The need for the company disappears before it's fully formed, and the organizer wants to withdraw it from the record in the corporation division. Presently, there's no provision for the organizer to dissolve the limited liability company. So the amendment that you have there is for the purpose of addressing that issue. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we made amendments last session, and we wound up not liking those, so that's what we're trying to fix with this bill.
Well, Senator Byer, Senator Harper, that's what Section 1 is designed to do. Basically, I think that there are a number of us who are involved in practicing in this area who were satisfied with what was there, but there's disagreement among counsel, and in some cases, conservatism wins out, and it becomes an incentive, perhaps, to organize a limited liability company under statutes of another state, which is permissible. We wanted to make clear that one could really use a rather broad general statement that members of the limited liability company can compete with it if that's what they choose to do. The criticism of the language that is there now was that it seems to imply one has to identify specific competing projects rather than a general statement, and that's the reason for the language in what is added to subsection 11 in section 1 of the bill, allowing the limited liability company to include a statement that the members can compete with the limited liability company in the conduct of its business, essentially pursuing a competing project. So that's the clarification that's involved.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And this may be more of a process question. I probably won't get an answer, but I assume we went through a very involved process to develop the language of 2 years ago that didn't work. We're becoming back in 03 and changing the amendment we make today, or do you think the system is in place now that we've got it pretty well refined?
Chair Byer, Senator Harper. We, in developing this particular bill, and particularly this section of it, most of the participants who were involved in the last discussion participated in the discussion of this provision. There were some others. I was not involved in that last time and was this time. We certainly hope we're not back here addressing this issue again.
There's not an answer to my question, I guess. But, so we put our best mind. This is not just one person's opinion that they're still swinging from the tree. We put this together with the committee structure as best we can.
That's correct.
Okay.
I guess I have a question on the what appears to be retroactivity nature of this amendment to this bill. It goes back to October 23rd, 99, which I'm assuming from memory was the date when the statute we passed in 99 went into effect. Is that correct?
That would be correct, yes.
Okay. Does this bill then, change any pending court action, or is the potential there that there is some court action that the retroactivity nature of this bill is designed to either change or potentially change?
I do not believe that it would affect any existing court action. We're dealing with some fine points, and I'm not aware of any situation in which that would be the case. The intention of that particular subsection was to make it clear exactly when these changes were to be effective, and to essentially clarify that what we're doing here in Section 1 is to clarify what we were trying to do in the beginning.
Mr. Chairman, I called legislative counsel on that same issue, and the answer I got this morning orally was that is what the witness has just said. It was intended to clarify the effective dates. It was not intended to actually change anything.
Okay. I guess that's just a concern, is that we knew that we had a change, 18 months ago, and now to say to go back to that 18-month period and say, well, that chapter of law, in a sense, never existed, and what you did is now under these new rules. My concern is that potentially going to change? And I recognize you give existing LLCs a period of time to either, the way I read this, and maybe I'm completely wrong, but you either can you know, choose to stay with the way you organized it for that 18-month period, or you can upgrade to this new system that where, in a sense, that 18-month period never existed?
The intention is, again, to clarify what was supposed to have been the effect of the bill in 1999. I guess I can offer to go back to the chairman of our task force and ask him to provide a letter to the committee that explains this in more detail than maybe I'm articulating at this point.
Don't know if that'd be necessary, but I think we understand what's going on here. As some of us just have been talking about with the upstairs the last hour of the UCC, is it every time we make changes, it seems like 2 years later we're back redoing the changes we made.
Well, it's something kind of going to bite us on this retroactive.
Well, and that's gets to my question: is there suits or cases out there that this change in this retroactively may, change the outcome of a suit or a case or an LLC or something that we don't know about yet, that 2 years from now we're going to be back saying, well, we didn't mean to be retroactive in that case because that's not what we wanted to do. And that's my concern, right, to make this retroactive.
Mm-hmm. Again, I guess without going any further with the issue, let me see if I can provide some clarification to the committee.
Thank you.
And some assurance that we're not creating a bind.
Mr. Chair, I think that, if you wouldn't mind, why would we want to be retroactive on this particular statute when that's pretty much an abnormal process around here? We rectify mistakes by starting fresh.
Yeah. If we could go back and undo all mistakes of past sessions, we'd be here for
the legislature of the 80s would be completely off the books.
Now, I like the way you say that, Tina. I think the way I would call the 80s were controlled by a certain party. And
I have no memory of that.
I wasn't here. She's the one that said the 80s. Remember that? Mr. Putnam.
If you would then just send that letter to me, I'll see to it that the committee gets it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing this forward. Does the department wish to comment on this bill at all? Is there anything that you're in the room just to observe and take note today?
The administrator of the committee has asked me to be here in case we've taken a look at this particular bill. We did have some questions that were primarily resolved. I have not seen the retroactive amendment.
Do we need to get that on the record?
I've got it. Jim, help me with your last name.
I'm sorry, it's Hardeman.
Mr. Hardeman, why don't you come forward and just introduce yourself to the committee so the committee members know who you are and make your statement on the record.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Jim Hardeman. I'm a senior policy advisor for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The committee administrator, Mr. Putman, had graciously invited me to attend today's hearing in case we had concerns about any of the four bills you're hearing. I've met and spoken with the primary movers of the bills. I've still got a few questions. None of them, I think, are serious enough to raise before the committee at this time. I think that we can get them resolved. And that includes Senate Bill 117. My only concern on 117 at this point is I thought I understood Mr. Morrow to indicate that he had a further amendment he had added.
No.
Okay.
No, it's the amendment that's in Section 2.
Okay, I had misunderstood then. We don't see anything in Senate Bill 117 from the department's perspective that we're particularly concerned about at this point.
Thank you. Welcome on to our committee. I'm sure it won't be the last time we see you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Harlan was particularly pleased that asking to come here on what was otherwise a state holiday.
Yeah, I'm sure. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 117, and we will wait to get the letter or some kind of confirmation about what's going on for activity there. With that, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 118. Mr. Putnam, would you like to give us any information before we call our first witness?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that this, too, is clarification of legislation out of the last session. It just makes it clear that an entity may merge or merge or convert into a business in another state under that other state's laws, not under Oregon's laws. And it, so I read it as just a clarification and a cleanup of the language. However, shouldn't say however, but in addition, I believe that an amendment will be proposed, which is supported by both the bar and by the department. The practice occurs from time to time where persons will go to the corporation division and file for a business name that includes the word bank, and the corporation division does not look behind that application and will issue whatever it's called, articles of incorporation, I guess, and then that title is taken offshore and sold in a fraudulent manner in the belief that this is a going banking concern in Oregon. And the amendment, as I understand it, is to require that such applications for corporate registration go through the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Thank you, Mr. Morrow.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill is proposed to be amended to address the issue that the committee administrator just described. I'm going to go through what the text of the bill you have right now does, and then ask Mr. Harlan to come up and add some explanation of the issue that's come up. I also think that there may be some additional amendments that the Secretary of State, the Corporation Division, may request to this bill at the risk of becoming a Christmas tree. This bill has the relating clause relating to business organizations, and that covers a lot of territory, so it allows for addressing a number of issues, and we're
Thank
trying
you.
To get
I noticed that relating clause also.
Mm-hmm. As was mentioned, the bill as drafted was to address a situation from last session, and given the questions on the previous bill, let me explain a little bit about that. Prior to last session, there were no provisions in the business registry statutes, that is the Corporation Act, the Limited Liability Company Act, and other statutes under which entities are organized that allowed for mergers among different kinds of entities or conversion from one type to another. A task force of the business law section presented legislation last session to address those issues and allow some of that process to go forward. To some degree, this was charting new territory because it is not something that there are a lot of statutes on in other jurisdictions. We were trying to respond to a need and address it without some guidance that typically we have, such as Model Business Corporation Act provisions. For that reason, there are some things that happened that were unanticipated and are part of what this bill is to address. The first section basically deals with a technical point of what has to be filed in one situation. The next group of sections deals with an issue involving assumed business names. In the process of conversion or merger, an entity that has an assumed business name, say a corporation that's converting to a limited liability company, it's on the records of the Corporation Division. When that change is made, the Secretary of State and the Corporation Division can move that name over to the new entity type and move from corporation to a limited liability company. In the case of a general partnership, that process doesn't work because an assumed business name for a general partnership is filed under the names of the partners. And the Secretary of State doesn't always know who those people are or how they connect with a particular entity that's filing a conversion. And so the purpose of the second group of sections is basically to put the responsibility for making that change in the assumed business name onto the individuals who are involved with it, and rather than the Secretary of State, something that they can't really effectively do. Third set of sections is basically just, again, dealing with a specific filing issue, who's supposed to sign articles of conversion when an entity converts from one type to another. Again, my example from a corporation to a limited liability company. And then sections 12 through the end of the bill address the question of entities changing jurisdictions of their organization. This is something that really was not primarily in the focus of the drafters of this bill. Our task force really was focusing on conversions and mergers among different types of Oregon entities. In fact, the Secretary of State brought to our attention the fact that this bill was, this legislation was being used to convert not only from an Oregon LLC to an Oregon corporation, but also from an Oregon LLC perhaps to an LLC in another jurisdiction. More common really with mergers than with conversions, because there isn't in most states a comparable legislation elsewhere. So the purpose of the other sections of the bill is to clarify the process by which those interstate conversions and mergers may take place. So that's basically what is in the bill that you have before you. I think at this point I'm going to ask Mr. Harlan to come up and maybe give some additional explanation with respect to the bank name issue. We're cooperating with the division in connection with that issue, and then I'll make some final remarks.
Maybe before we get into that, any questions? Go ahead, Mr. Harlan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Jim Harlan. I'm a senior policy advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. In about the last 18 months, Oregon has become the Grand Cayman of brass plate banks, at least in the United States. We have the dubious distinction of being the only state in the Union in which it has become theoretically possible to form a bank under the corporation code, take that articles of incorporation, the documents for that bank, and sell it offshore. The sales pitch that the scallywags use is that this is a bank that's fully formed under the laws of the United States, and in the most narrow technical sense, that is correct. And they are selling these articles of incorporation for significant amounts of money. They are also using these charters to operate themselves as a bank offshore and solicit significant numbers, amounts of funds from victims. We have been working with the Secretary of State for about 18 months. The problem is this. The Secretary of State, under the under ORS Chapter 60 is essentially a ministerial agency. And they really don't have the legal authority, and they don't have the staffing to be able to make these screenings. So we are going to be proposing an amendment in which we can set in place a mechanism whereby people who want to file articles of incorporation that deal with banks and other kinds of financial activities need to have some kind of written authority from us before they go forward with filing those articles of incorporation. We have done some drafts in the amendments. Mr. Morrow has been gracious enough to spend a lot of time and energy on this with us. We're very close. We just have a few jots and tittles that we need to get, and then we'll be ready to offer that to the committee. And I appreciate your patience, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Senator Harper.
Well, why just banks? It seems like this would be abused of any number of different types of activities.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, actually we are expanding this beyond banks. I was just trying to use banks as an example of to identify the problem. But we are attempting an amendment that would go further than that and deal with associated financial activities.
I guess I would be concerned if you could ever make it broad enough as long as the statute's in place. Somebody's going to figure out a way to turn anything into a scam if we leave this loophole open, aren't they?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, that... I've been at this long enough to know that by the time we get a fix drafted and put into law, the scam artists, the scallywags of the world have already leaped ahead of us. All we can do is try to stay even. We think we've got an amendment that you'll like, at least in terms of dealing with this problem.
And then. What are the charters? I mean, what kind of banks are we talking about here? Are these federal banks? Are these state? I mean, I know all the various bank types, but I didn't hear in your testimony what. I mean, is this a state bank? Never.
Mr. Chairman?
This would be a bank that this apparently applies to, I guess. I didn't understand who that was.
Mr. Chairman? Senator Atkinson? In this technical sense, it would be a state chartered, if you will. It is not a state chartered bank in the true sense. If it's a true state chartered bank, it comes through our agency, and our banking people issue a charter to operate a bank. But in the sense that it's going through state law, it certainly is a state-formed entity. The articles of incorporation are fairly elaborate. The International Bank of Commerce is a name, for example, that has been filed with the Secretary of State. That's the charter that is sold offshore.
Doesn't this arrangement still have to meet a needs and convenience before the articles of incorporation are released?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, not under the Corporation Code, it doesn't.
Really? So is that, again, isn't it, so that is part of that, that's, unless I'm just slow to the party.
Current,
a hiccup, isn't it?
Current Bank Act in Oregon is that if you're going to operate a bank, you need to come through our agency.
Maybe elaborate a little bit. Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, the problem really comes with what's in the Business Corporation Act, and I researched the history of this, and this problem actually goes all the way back to 1985 when there were changes made to all of the statutes governing business entities to take the Secretary of State out of the process of determining what names can be used by various entities. The unfortunate result of that, and it's only actually come into play in the last two or three years, is that there's no ability for the Secretary of State to say, wait a minute, this has bank in its name, it goes over here, it should be filed through the process dealing with the Department of Consumer and Business Services rather than simply filing in the Corporation Division. So the amendment is designed to essentially put that process back in place so that rather than simply filing something that has the word bank in it, the Secretary of State can look to at that entity and say, wait a minute, we've got to get clearance over here from the department. And the issue that we, Mr. Harlow and I have been talking about and trying to refine this is to make sure that we've covered as much of the loopholes as we can. I mean, part of the effort here is to make this process essentially more difficult and in that way send these people someplace else. The process right now, unfortunately, is easy for them to use. We want to make it harder.
One more quick question. Under the, I think it was 1997 Interstate Banking Act that essentially started to tear down the walls of what is a bank and what isn't a bank, doesn't that, in a sense, create more tracking hurdles for your agency? If you set up articles of incorporation for an investment company that acts like a bank that owned a car dealership, I mean, as I understand it, under the Interstate Banking Act, all those things legally can occur. I don't need to be too. That's my last question. I guess I don't understand. I mean, I understand that we're closing a loophole, but are we not opening up a bigger one?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, I think a part of the answer to that question is exactly what entities who are complying with the law generally can really use the term bank. That's still a process that has some federal and state regulation to it. Obviously, you're broadening the scope of financial services enterprises, but I think that if we push this process into the regulation of the department, and it's really only dealing with the state law aspects of it, it is contributing to slowing down the process, and I think to a large degree eliminating it. These people like these entities because they can use the word bank, and it carries some weight that implies the United States and the state of Oregon have reviewed it.
We will make sure, I guess, to take Senator Atkinson's comments and to note when you're working on your amendment that we don't want to create a larger loophole in the process of closing the loophole. We don't want to throw the door open. Senator Harper.
Is this just an Oregon problem? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, currently this is an Oregon problem. The reason it's an Oregon problem is I recently did a survey of the other states, and they break down along one of two lines. Either they have statutory authority in the counterpart to the corporation code that gives that person who administers that law the authority to say, no, you got to go across the street and talk to our banking folks. So it's in the law specifically. The other group of states has, first of all, a corporation code that is not as clearly ministerial as Oregon's happens to be. And there is an informal arrangement that has been worked out between the Secretary of State's office and the banking regulator, where if a filing comes in to the Secretary of State that has one of these trigger names, they simply send the people over across the street to the bank regulator and say, when you bring back an okay slip, then we'll file this, otherwise we won't.
Maybe that's what we're going to do.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, yes, that's part of the process here, is to essentially define a list of names that have to go to the department for clearance, and also to make sure that, should somebody try and challenge this process, that the department has something to back that up.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I understand that we have a problem here in Oregon, but I don't know how large the problem is. And if you could provide a recent example that would help me get my arms around what the problem looks like, that would help me a great deal.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, there are two aspects to this, I think, in response to your question. First of all, there was a recent example in which a set of filed articles of incorporation were taken offshore and used by the scallywags to induce a European interest to forward $300,000 to a non-existent trustee in the state of Oregon based on those articles. And that money is now gone. There was no trustee, there was no fund, and we have not been able to trace those dollars. The injured party was not an Oregonian. That's true. The injured parties so far in both situations where money is simply released offshore, the injured parties are not normally Oregonians. They are citizens of other countries. The concern we have is that we remove Oregon as the vehicle, as the facilitator for this kind of wrongdoing. We have an investigator who has been looking at a number of these cases, and I'm in the process. I was not prepared to testify in detail today on this, but I'm in the process of having him assemble anecdotal evidence for when we do testify, and I have specifically asked him to identify any kind of Oregon funds that have gone missing involved in this.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's information that I would like to be able to add to the record, information that helps us quantify the problem as well as talk about it in general terms as we are today.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, I guess I'd like to point out that the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, to the extent they've identified these entities, has posted them on their website. There's a list of unauthorized banks, and I think to some degree that list plus the efforts of the department have avoided some other situations that might otherwise have occurred.
Mr. Chairman, just a brief follow on that, and I thank Mr. Morrow for bringing that up. We have had a number of inquiries based on that website that we have posted, these fictitious bank names. Most of those calls are coming from offshore, but at least it's helped slow this down a little bit.
Does anybody know why the Secretary of State didn't revoke?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harper, the problem with revoking is twofold. First of all, like any other revocation action, we need to go through an administrative process to do it, and that's fine. Nobody has an objection to doing that. The problem with going through the process is that the damage has already been done. By the time we get around to revoking a charter, the evil people have already sold it. They don't care if it's revoked or not. They've done their damage. in those instances, the revocation, if in fact we get this amendment through, we've already got a provision in there for doing post-effective revocations. The revocation at that point will then harm the victim in the first round of fraud. They're the ones who will lose the charter.
Other criminal minds always find a way.
Mr. Chair, but again, the effect of the legislation would be to just limit. We're not going to be able to stop the practice altogether. I mean, you mentioned the experience of other states. I mean, are there other states out there who've gone beyond limiting to actually stopping the practice?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, if in fact the amendments go through, it will stop the practice. If they come to us with a proposed articles of incorporation for the Grand Bank of Booza, they will not get a letter of authority from us.
Okay. And I use the word limit in the way that it's been used in the material we have. This says that the bill is designed in part to limit, and there's a difference to me in limit and stop. So,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, I think that the limit is perhaps not quite accurate. I mean, the intention is to stop this practice.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, as Mr. Harlan suggested, criminal minds are devious, and they may find some other way to do this, but to the extent that we can think ahead of them, the intention is to stop the practice.
Mm-hmm. You're successful for about 15 years.
I appreciate the clarification. Thank you.
Seeing no one else has signed up to testify, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 118. And I would like to thank you, Ms. Morrow, for bringing that handy relating clause to the committee.
Mm-hmm.
We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 119. Mr. Cutman, do you have anything for SCR?
Same areas
here.
Same of characters. This really has to do with what has to happen when a corporation wishes to take an action without holding a stockholders meeting. And apparently Oregon is a state that requires unanimous consent of stockholders to hold or to take an action without a vote of the stockholders. And it's alleged by persons who are interested in this bill that there are many other states where you do not need unanimous consent, and so it's easier to organize there, or preferable to organize there than here. This is an attempt to get rid of the requirement for unanimity, but at the same time puts in some safeguards when that practice is used. It does not require the corporation to abandon that practice if they choose to keep it.
Thank you. Ms. Morrow.
Again, Andy Morrow, attorney with Foster Pepper and Shuffleman in Portland, and here representing the Oregon State Bar Business Law Section. Very briefly, this provision is primarily a response to provisions in the Delaware corporation law. As the committee is aware, Delaware is the place where the largest number of corporations are incorporated. From folks from out of state who are investing in Oregon businesses, they're familiar with that law. They're comfortable with it. They sometimes push us to use Delaware law when the corporation and its attorneys and other advisors would prefer to have the entity organized under Oregon law. This is one provision that has been focused upon by venture capitalists and others as an explanation for why they want to organize under Delaware law. So that's partly the reason for the response. Again, it basically allows the corporation to amend its articles, or going forward after this time, a new corporation could be organized, which has a provision allowing non-unanimous consent. Right now, in order to take an action that requires shareholder approval, one has to either call a meeting, which requires a minimum of 10 days notice, and in a larger corporation, it takes more time, or written consent action can be taken, but it requires unanimity. If there's one individual who's out of town and can't be reached, that process can't be used either. And in many of these cases, it turns out to be the shareholder has 1% who's gone, and the issue isn't in doubt. It's simply a matter of process. So this is designed to respond to that issue. Mr. Harlan brought to my attention this morning a question that he had with respect to this bill, and that's the reason for the amendment that you have before you. He asked that the bill clarify that using this process does not affect the rights of dissenting shareholders. It is not the intention to eliminate those rights with respect to shareholders who don't consent to the action that the corporation is taking. If you had a shareholder meeting and those rights were available, the shareholder obviously could take advantage of them. There is no intention to take those rights away from people who do not want to consent. At the same time, we've also clarified that the people who do consent, like a shareholder who votes in favor at a meeting, do not have those rights available. They've chosen to go along with the action.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. If you could help me understand how big is the problem that we are out to correct. And, for example, how many venture capitalists and other investors have cited this as a problem? How much business has been lost? Is that documented someplace where we can capture the information?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't know of any place where that is documented. Basically, I am in the process of drafting this, the section, we're basically working from anecdotal evidence of the people who were active in this practice. I have worked with the Business Corporation Act issues since back in about 1985. This issue has been discussed from time to time before, and it became is becoming apparent that the issue is just coming up more and more frequently. Partly I think it's a matter of that there is so much more venture capital investment going on, or at least was up until earlier this year. But I don't have any, I don't know of any place where that information is kept, sort of statistical answer. I'm sorry.
Okay, and so just to follow up, Mr. Chair. Yes. So we're moving forward based on anecdotal information, and that's not necessarily a negative thing, but is the Oregon State Bar advancing the legislation on behalf of someone or groups that are concerned about this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, no. There is no individual or group who is specifically trying to be advantaged in this process. It is a response particularly to a couple of members of our section executive committee who are very active in this practice, who said this is a problem for us in our practice. We would like to organize these entities under Oregon law. We're being asked to organize these under Delaware law. Here's the reason why. Please take care of it. I would be happy to invite some of those people to testify or to provide evidence for the record, letters responding to that, if that would be of assistance to the committee.
Sounds like that may be helpful. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Decker.
I can just recall, though it's still anecdotal in nature, one conversation where that circumstances was cited as one reason amongst many that proved to be difficult in terms of organizing a business in Oregon. And so, though it's anecdotal, it's certainly the person who was expressing it had a great deal of passion for it.
Well, that brings up another point, I guess, and that is something I've been interested in pursuing, but haven't gone to legislative council. I don't know if the bar has listened to it, that I think that Oregon could perhaps become the Delaware of the West Coast with our high-tech industry, you know, in close proximity here. What other changes would be needed in order to bring us more closely in line with Delaware's, you know, corporation laws? I do know that from what little research I've done, they have a court there dealing strictly with corporate law, which is one reason why corporations want to incorporate there, because they know how they're going to be treated in court. Are there other things we could do besides this that would bring us closer to that, so we could get more, become the Delaware of the West Coast?
Mr. Chairman, this is the issue that is most often cited as the primary difference in terms of what can be done statutorily, beyond things like the Delaware Chancery Court, which obviously is an important factor. There's simply no way to overcome the history that Delaware has in terms of the depth of law that it has on a whole range of corporate issues. I think we have done and continue to try and do, and this bill is part of that process, to make the statute as friendly, if you will, to business enterprises and encourage them to be organized here. I don't have at this point any other statutory recommendations based upon things that have come to my attention. I think our challenge is to point out that our statute is equal to Delaware in terms of its flexibility. That's the answer that we try to give, and continue to push for that as an advantage, because in one sense, once one goes beyond outside of the state of Oregon, you're incurring additional costs for the corporation. They have to have file in Delaware. They have to have a registered agent in Delaware. It's a process that creates some expense. Those are the things we're trying to do to respond, but I think in terms of the statute, the Business Corporation Act, I feel we've done a good job in trying to keep up with Delaware, if you will.
So if we pass this, DuPont's going to move here to the Hager Stadium?
That's what we're working towards.
You had a question?
Just a very minor point, Mr. Chairman. The amendment that was distributed says that section subsection 5, there's already a subsection 5, if I'm reading the bill correctly, and we just make this any number that legislative council thinks it ought to be?
Yes, and my apologies. That's an oversight on my part.
Thank you. I was wondering if we were replacing the subsection 5 that was in the bill, but apparently we need a different number there.
Mr. Chair, I do have one additional question.
Yes.
There is something that I don't quite understand, and this has to do with the public policy implication. What's stated in our materials is that the bill will not apply to all corporations, only those who elect to provide for it in their articles of incorporation, et cetera. Can you help me understand why we're not doing all corporations?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, the reason for that is to the extent that there are existing corporations where the shareholders feel to some degree protected by the fact that these actions can only be done through a meeting or through unanimous consent, it was not our intention to impose that situation on them. The there are certain of these situations where corporations rely upon the existing law rather than agreements, and perhaps maybe shouldn't, but the intention was not to to impose this process on corporations who didn't want to go along with it.
If I remember your original testimony correctly, the provisions are here so that corporations could amend their articles to include this provision.
Yes, that is correct.
But they don't have to.
Right.
And corporations formed in the future, if this becomes law, have the option of doing either or.
That is correct. And again, the articles of incorporation are always on file with the Secretary of State, so the information is available to a shareholder or investor if they care to go look.
Okay. Thank you very much for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else? Boy, the crowd just stands with an arm, and this bill seems to be the one that brought all the people in the room. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing. And are you going to talk about Wednesday? Wednesday, yes. Mr. Putman, you want to bring us up to date with happening Wednesday?
I'll try. We've been invited to join the House Committee in Room 50 at 3:30 on Wednesday to hear a presentation. Really, it's more on economic development than on anything else. We're not prepared to move forward on those bills in our committee, and I think we'll get a lot more. But this is an opportunity to join them, hear the presentation if you wish. I haven't posted the agenda yet because I don't know if we're a joint committee or simply aren't going to meet but are invited to go there as guests. So stay tuned, and I'll let you know. It really doesn't matter. Just come to Room 50 at 3:30 if you want to hear the presentation.
That's our Wednesday meeting. That is our Wednesday meeting, yeah. We will not be having a meeting here. We'll be either guests of the House Committee or a joint committee of the House Committee, however it comes out. It's their place. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, just one question on the first bill, Senate Bill 116.
Yes.
In my mind, I guess a couple of the players are still here. I've just been trying to sort through that in my mind. I'm wondering if, and I guess they'll bring some of that information to the chair, is that in other states they have a similar statute on the books, and if they've experienced some of the problems that were brought up by some of the last testimony, I would just be curious to know if some of those problems had surfaced in other states that may have similar statutes.
We're no longer hearing on that one. We do have those parties, I think, are going to get together, and if they'll be back, we'll have an issue back in front of us. If Mr. Art is here, he's heard your request, so we can certainly bring some of that issue at the time. And if they can't work out their differences, then it becomes our job to work them out for them.
You say that with a certain relish.
Well, many times that gets irrevocable differences decided out in the hallway when they realize that legislators will decide those differences for them if they don't do it on their own. So we will let them attempt to do that. If there's nothing else, we will adjourn the meeting. Thank you very much for your time.